a delight to be able to introduce Dr. George Sayre as the recipient of our Health System Impact Award. As many of you may know, we established these awards a number of years ago, in part to acknowledge work that many of our researchers were doing that had substantial impact on the health system, but didn't always generate new grant funding or even major publications, but had influence sort of out of proportion, and often which required a lot of behind-the-scenes work. We recognize that our researchers have impact in a lot of ways in our health system, and one of those impacts is by being a resource for our various program partners who often need help and analysis and help in understanding their data on relatively rapid timelines. George's work on access and implementation of some of the VA's initiative to expand access has really been a great example of that. And he's an example of someone who has pursued a line of work with a variety of support, support from our research office, but support directly from VA program offices like the Office of Analytics and Business Intelligence and the Office of Veterans Access. And his work really helped the VA understand problems that first emerged to, or really emerged on the national scale with problems of our waitlist crisis, but also help understand the policy responses that Congress initiated, first with the CHOICE Act and then now with the Mission Act. So with that, I just want to turn it over to George to talk about his findings. The last thing I'll just say is his findings sort of exemplify the real strengths of VA research, which is to be able to bring deep sort of qualitative understanding along with the quantitative measures of access so that both clinicians and policymakers can really understand the impact of what we do when we try to deal with a real problem, such as patients waiting too long for care in the VA. Thank you.
Thank you so much, David. And I want to start by saying I feel a little uncomfortable receiving this award, though I shamelessly will be go ahead and take credit for other people's work, because as everyone on the on this call knows, is that nobody in the HS in research works alone, especially in HSR&D. And so it is a little strange to have one person be singled out for so many people's work, but I'll take it. And the other thing that's a little uncomfortable about the award, though I encourage you to keep giving them, David, is that really there's nobody in HSR&D who doesn't have an impact on the quality of care veterans are getting. And that's all the way from our local, national, local leadership and research staff. So everyone who's on this call has made veterans' access to care better and their quality of care better, probably both. So what I'd like to do today, there we go, is I want to walk through just a few selected projects I've had the good fortune to be involved with that either focus on understanding access or improving access. And I want to also kind of commingle that, do that in a way that talks a little about my research journey, which has been very rewarding but also a little atypical in some ways, and share some of the lessons I've been able to learn. And finally, I want to talk a little at the end about what are some of the next steps in VA's efforts to improve or understand access, some that one that's just kind of starting that I think is exciting and kind of really typifies where the VA is going and where we're leading on, and one that's kind of a very long-term goal in which I don't have any much of a slide for because I don't know how it's going to work, but we'll be talking about that. So I want to start first with talking about access in the VA, because the VA is very unique in a few ways, and it provides both unique challenges and some unique opportunities. As you all know, you're familiar with this notion that our mission is to serve those who serve. And this makes our healthcare as an integrated healthcare system quite unique. First off, we're responsible and committed to any veteran anywhere. Okay. And so that poses issues around the fact that there's no geographic boundary, there's no socioeconomic boundary, there's no employment boundary that defines some catchment for us, okay? And even though we currently serve every veteran, we're responsible for every veteran. So we're trying to serve veterans who aren't even enrolled through homeless programs, et cetera, and their healthcare status really can vary too. I like to think that in the VA, the only pre-existing condition we ever have to think about is their service. And so part of our work here is really we're part of paying a nation's debt to these people, which makes it a very unique kind of work. The flip side of all the challenges is this is, if you're interested in studying access, there's probably no better place in the country you can do it than in the VA because of the challenges we have and because of the commitment we have to providing access to such a rich population that both geographically and in their diversity. And so it's been a really marvelous place to work. It is a marvelous place to work on this particular topic. As a little background, before I get into the next couple slides, I want to give a little context to that. For some of my work, I actually mid-career changed paths and started working in VA. I'm a family psychologist training and a qualitative researcher, and really had very little interest in health services per se. I hadn't thought about the phrase access to care ever, but I was contacted through serendipity by Jackie Zarka, who's our administrative officer here and has been a researcher here in our center in Seattle. And they had a really large data set of qualitative interviews with veterans and their partners looking at PTSD and intimate partner violence. And they had this, and they needed a family or a couple's health, a qualitative researcher, which is a really narrow niche, and so it was easy to fill, so I did some work there, and I just found the setting here in the VA in Seattle at the center to be really generative and really attractive place to work, so I moved from my practicing and my faculty position at Seattle University in the Department of Psychology to doing research here, and I found it extremely rewarding. But as I mentioned, I don't come to this work with a health services research background, and I really had no interest, access was not on my radar, until like most of the country, it became really prevalent and on everybody's radar, both us, those of us in the VA, and the nation in 2014 when we had the access crisis. And as many of you may remember, there was a very large audit performed at that time to look at staff understanding of scheduling procedures, wanted to understand how frequently inappropriate and appropriate scheduling procedures and record keeping was done within the VA. Okay, and also identify factors that interfere with schedules' ability to do appropriate scheduling and or provide timely care. And this project was in part being conducted and overseen by the Office of Analytics and Business Intelligence, of which Steve Finn was the director at the time, and we were in the same office space. And so I'm going to mention serendipity a fair amount throughout this whole thing because I think it's a key to someone's career in many ways. And so my introduction to Access is I was aware of this going on, and Steve walked up to my desk one day and said, we're collecting some data related to the stand down. Would you be willing to look at it? And I said, in full ignorance, sure. And what came out of that was that over the next, that the VA had collected over just a few months, looked at every facility. It was a total of 731 facilities, including 140 parent sites on all the VMCs. And there's a collection of about a little over 3,200, very short, meaning one sentence to maybe a small paragraph of interviews. So it's still a massive amount of data, which Steve was clever enough to not mention that's what it would look like before he asked me to help. And the other issue with that was the rapid turnaround had to be done. We thought at first we'd have a couple months, ended up having to be done in 23 days. And so if you look at the slide on the bottom, there's something called distributed manifest contents analysis, which if you're a qualitative researcher, you won't recognize because we made it up. Because we were trying to figure out what are we going to do with this. And one of the nice things about being in the VA is we have tremendous resources. So we divvied the data up. Manifest content analysis, which people, if you're a qualitative researcher, you may recognize, is simply counting. We're just looking at the data for indicators of something present, not present. We also look for whether the data is not, we can't tell from the data, or there was a clear indication that it wasn't there. Someone said, we never did X. And so we would do these spreadsheets, and we managed to produce a report within 23 days that looked at that kind of the distribution of that scheduling behaviors. And the first part I want to share is just the findings, give people a little picture of that. And so what we found is about 93% of people described that desired date was picked rather than determining the desired date. So the desired date, which we don't use anymore, but the desired date was supposed to indicate when the veteran wanted to come in, and it was routinely done, just when is the next time they could get in. About 80% of sites reported being instructed to alter dates previously entered on wait lists. At 15 sites, respondents talked about feeling threatened or coerced to follow inappropriate scheduling behaviors, and a small number reported punitive actions after raising concerns with supervisors. The barriers we heard a lot about were undue focus on performance measures, complicated scheduling practices, clearly is often still true, inadequate staffing, low morale, and just not enough resources. So this is kind of the picture. Even though the data was very thin, it was very large in the sense of we had so many of them. And we could still hear some voice in this. And as a qualitative researcher, I'm always interested in what's the voice of the participants. Our conclusion on this was that this data reflected a culture in which the preoccupation with arbitrary and unrealistic performance measures, mainly everyone is seen within 14 days, led to widespread improper scheduling practices, and that some frontline, middle, and senior managers felt compelled to manipulate these scheduling process. The phrase I used in my report was really created, the focus on numbers created a moral hazard. And this experience, even though it was a really large data set, it was not collected for a lot of depth, it really struck me that this notion of access is a very human experience. And that it's a human experience, not only for the veterans going in, this really weighs on the staff and it impacted the staff. And also brought home to me that that measuring access as a blunt, the practice of measuring and understanding access with a blunt quantitative measure really is not only fails to capture the complexity of it, but it has enormous problems. So a couple lessons learned in that. The first one is say yes. Okay, so been fortunate that I've have some impact in access. It's just because you say yes to some guy who walks up to your desk, some guy being Steve Finn. But I think one thing that really helps your research is to not plan it all out ahead of time and stick to your path, but say yes to opportunities that come along. I think serendipity just be a phenomenally good way to discover what's out there rather than deciding ahead what you're going to look for. The other one, and research lesson, is always expect unintended consequences. They rarely, let's hope, will be as problematic as the waitlist crisis, but I think anytime a large system does something, anytime we implement something, there's going to be unintended consequences. And we have to conduct research to not only anticipate that, but to build in a way to identify those as they happen. So the other way to look at access is, as I mentioned, is a lived experience. I'm a qualitative researcher, and what's really become my main focus in my research is to make sure that our policies and our access efforts are informed by both veterans' perspectives and experience, but also providers and staff. When we as an organization make policies or we make performance measures that don't reflect and are not informed by the realities on the ground, and both as we're planning them but also after the fact, it's going to have problems, and it's not going to accurately reflect what's going on, and it's not going to provide the greatest access to veterans. So I want to talk some about improving access. Currently, there's two ways to approach that, and I borrowed this phrase. Evan Carey, one of our researchers I work with, uses it. The VA is really looking at two main ways to do this. And the question is, for everything we do, are we going to build it, which means improving our existing care modalities or developing new ones so that we have it within the VA, or where do we buy that, which has to do with care in the community? So I want to highlight three projects, and there's more I can talk about. There's so many that we do, but I want to talk about each of these because they have something unique to offer our understanding of access. And the first one is part of what we were doing when I first started here. My first project was connected with the Office of Specialty Care, and was Specialty Care Evaluation. And we're looking at e-consults and scan echoes. For those of you who are not familiar with these two things, if you're a provider, you almost certainly are, but Scan Echo is a video specialty care training and consultation PCPs program in which specialist staff case-specific material and make treatment recommendations. They also have an element of that in training the PCPs out at CBOC. It's a hub-and-spoke model where the PCP at a particular CBOC can become, say, the expert in endocrinology. They can handle the diabetes cases, et cetera. It's the VA's version of the ECHO program, which was developed outside the VA. And the other project we're looking at the implementation of was electronic consults. E-consults. These are basically ways to use electronic messaging where, again, primary care providers can put in a consult electronically and get feedback without sending the patient there. And two things I want to point out about this. First off, for these two projects, is that they were not they're not specifically about overtly necessarily focused on access or also about quality of care, improving quality of care, but they have profound access implications. One thing I've learned about access is that improving access is rather ubiquitous. We have a lot of programs and VA efforts that really aren't designed necessarily to improve access, but that's part of what they do. An example we have, one of the projects I'm working with is the safety and value query, which is looking at the implementation of overused, effective, potentially harmful in medical practices. Well, it's really not an access problem, but there is a side effect of access and an outcome if we're doing things that aren't providing quality care or aren't providing value or maybe even risk. If we eliminate those, it creates more access in its size. The other thing interesting about these two projects, and I was working on these at the same time as the access waitlist happened, and it made me very conscious of access, is that access to care can actually be something called indirect access. And so in this case, both of these provided indirect access to specialty care. And what I mean by that is that this is a case where not only is the patient not having face-to-face contact with the provider, the specialist, but they're having no contact with the specialist. But they actually still have improvement when their PCP staffs their case through ScanEcho or their PCP sends an e-consult, and it improves care because they don't have to drive so far. Frequently, two of the things we found is that an e-consult, by not driving, so they may not have to drive into the VMC to get care because now it can be done in the PCP office, but also that they don't have to waste time because frequently prior to e-consult, people drive or travel to a VMC, they get there, the tests hadn't been done, they hadn't had a proper evaluation, or possibly, and they're sent back home to go get those things. So it really creates an efficiency, and as you see from the two quotes, the providers really thought that this improved access, even though that's not, really wasn't the primary focus of that. The main driver, originally at the conception of doing that project. So, a couple lessons learned from this. This was a project of specialty care. Crucial to both develop and I'm going to say collaborative relationships with operational partners. One of the things we've been really lucky about, and very fortunate that we have really active. So Susan Kirsch, who was in the Office of Specialty Care now, is Director of Office of Veteran Access to Care. She was very engaged in the very beginning of this project. And
George, I'm sorry to interrupt. Your audio is deteriorating a bit. Can you make sure all your... Everything's plugged in and you're close to the speaker and all that good stuff. Thank you.
Okay. Is that better?
Much. Thanks.
Okay. Sorry about that. We developed a relationship operational with
I'm sorry to say, it's actually still cutting out, I'm sorry to say. Are you by chance using a headset or anything? Could I get you to pick up the...
I am. Well, pick up the phone.
Yeah, thank you so much. Let's see if that clears it up a little bit. It just happened within the last 30 seconds or so. Let me know when you have the receiver picked up, and we'll do a little audio check.
Hi, is that?
And I think that's going to work. Yeah, I think that's going to work for us. Well, I'll let you know, but
sorry.
I think that sounds good. Thank you.
And the other component that is also the changing needs, is quite rapid. Is it beginning to end? And continue to just kind of produce what we produce. So part of working with our partners is really being responsive to their
I'm so sorry to interrupt again. It is still cutting out. I hate to interrupt your presentation like this, but do you possibly have a cell phone that you could call in on or try again from the landline?
I think I will call in on another number. Apologies.
Oh, no, not a problem at all. And the number is under the audio section of your control panel, so it should be right there. So I'll hold on and fill some dead air, and we'll give you just a second to call back in, and we really appreciate it. Thank you to all of our attendees for your patience. As we know, we can only control so many factors, but sometimes technology and even audio is going to do what it's going to do. So we appreciate your patience while Dr. Sayre calls back in. I terribly hate to interrupt his presentation. I know it can throw a wrench in the flow of the talk. However, it is very important that we hear what he has to say during this important presentation. So I think it's worth it for us all to stick around and hear the rest of it. And for those of you that are typing in looking for a copy of today's slides, you do have access to those. You can refer back to the reminder email you received a couple of hours ago, or you can write into the question section and request a copy of the slides, and I can send that link right over to you. And if you know anybody that wasn't able to join today but was interested in this talk or maybe interested in the Access initiatives, then you can always forward to them the follow-up email that you will receive, which will have the archive link to this recording, and you should get that in about 2 days. So it'll have the live link leading directly to the recording, as well as a copy of the handouts. So you can feel free to pass that far and wide so that we can give George's work the attention that it deserves. So again, thank you so much for your patience, and I do see more people writing in for the slides. So again, feel free to send me a message, and I will happily shoot that link over to you. And there's a PDF version that you can download and hold on to. And it shouldn't be much longer now. So again, I'm really appreciative that everybody is sticking around. This is an important honor, and it's important that we recognize our colleagues and the efforts that they're putting in. And again, if you do have any questions or comments for Dr. Sayre, you can also write those into the question section. And when he's done with his portion of the presentation, I will be happy to read those aloud to him. And we do have two more awardees that will also be presenting their work at the end of May on May.
Is that better?
Oh, that sounds so much better. Thank you so much, George.
I appreciate you taking the time.
No problem. We didn't lose any audience members. Go ahead.
We can discuss the irony of, in fact, I work on telemedicine sometimes later. Let's go ahead and move on. Sorry about that loss of time. The next project that I was involved with, and this built on our relationship with specialty care. This came out of Office of Veteran Access to Care, was implementing the group practice manager in the VA. So this was part of the Choice Act required that and mandated that we use in outpatient ambulatory care, especially in primary care, that we really start to use what's called advanced clinical management processes. And the way the VA decided to address that part of the Choice Act was to develop a new position we hadn't had called the group practice manager. Okay. And they began hiring those. This was actually conducted under the Office of Veteran Access to Care and spearheaded from the OVAC. OVAC. And we did a qualitative evaluation, myself and Dr. Rubenstein out of LA, of the five initial sites. And this is an example, again, of building. This is an example of taking our existing services, our ambulatory services, and trying to improve them to increase access and improve access. So what a few of the findings were that this is the first time that sites that they have a single point person focused on access. The group practice manager, their primary role is to make sure that every part of the VAMC or the clinic that they're in is maximizing veteran access to care. And one of the things that happens in the VA is we generate an awful lot of initiatives. So and the Office of Access to Care and other central offices will have a lot of sometimes even competing, potentially conflicting criteria and performance thresholds on here's what we're doing now. And this is the first time at each site that there's a single person who manages those, prioritizes, and implements those initiatives. And we've consistently heard that that's highly effective and creating teamwork that wasn't happening before. Okay, which brings us to the second quote there, is that they're focusing on organizational structure aimed at access for the first time. Okay, part of this, the last quote if you look at, I think is quite important, one of the things we heard about both in this and some subsequent research we'll talk about, is that it really represented a culture shift. VA has always used metrics of some sort to measure things. But part of what the GPMs were spearheading was kind of shift to focusing on understanding using metrics to improve, be a data-driven culture, which improves access. And without having that person on the front line doing that, it's very hard to get that moving. Out of that relationship and that work came a project we're still currently, that's still ongoing, which was evaluating Choose VA. This was originally called My VA Access. The titles have been changed, but it's still part of this, the consolidated focus of how is the VA improving access so that veterans can choose VA for their care. And this was launched in 2016, and it was designed to really rapidly increase veteran access to care and decrease wait times. Okay. The operation, this work is funded by Office of Rural Health and sponsored by the Office of Veteran Access to Care. Piazza, David O., Michael Ho, and myself. This is an ongoing project. The data collection we've already completed is we did 21 site visits. This were conducted over 5 months. We used open-ended interviews. We had 18 interviewers from 6 VAs. We conducted 127 focus groups, 81 individual interviews, collected about 145 hours of audio, and a little under 3,000 pages of transcripts for that. And I'll talk some about that piece later. And we've also completed 48 phone-based interviews with a national sample of veterans. Okay. We ended up using 13 analysts from 3 VAs. We did some very fast, rapid template analysis for the qual people out there, and then moved towards inductive content analysis because the data is really, really thick. And I want to talk some about our findings and then a little about the analytic process and some lessons learned. So the first lesson learned before I get into the other finding is that complex subjects require complex projects. As you can see from the amount of data we collected, even if you're not a qualitative researcher, you can imagine it's pretty complicated to do that. The reason we did that, collected that amount of data, and we used that many analysts and have been spending this much time on it, is because improving access is really complicated. We went in with a pretty broad question. We had 9 different aims around access, including providing same-day access to mental health, same-day access to primary care, and then there were several other ones. But our first question we asked every participant is, just tell us about what your site is doing to improve access. Now, the great thing about that is they can tell us anything they want, and so it really allows the participants to drive what the focus is. We can really understand at each site what they're prioritizing and how they conceptualize access. The downside of that is the data is all over the map. It's not easily categorizable, but we think it's really crucial because we want to understand the complexity of what's happening on the ground. The second part of the complexity is our interviews with veterans. We start with a very broad question. We're just asking them, tell me about getting care in the VA. We're not really talking to them about time. We're not asking them to tell us how long it takes you to get an appointment. We're not how far you have to drive. What we're doing is letting them tell us what's important. One of the interesting things we'll talk about is the fact that they don't talk about time. They do talk about driving, but no one's mentioned days. That's not the way they conceptualize access. And so I think to really understand complex subjects, you've got to be able to comfortable and not be afraid of collecting very complex data. An upshot of that, you better cherish your colleagues. I'm very fortunate to work at a place I really like everyone I work with. And I think that's that's not just kind of a nice side effect. Site visits are complicated. It's a demanding project. We took a lot of analysts into, and if you're a qualitative researcher on the phone, you'll understand this, what we call very weedy work, many of whom hadn't done that kind of work. And you really need to kind of help them and care about them and support each other. I feel I don't work with anyone from an investigator to a staff member who doesn't know things I don't. And I think our teams work really well. If you really actually enjoy your colleagues and make sure that they're growing and that by the end of this project, I think we'll all be better researchers than we were before we started. So a couple findings from this. First one, and I'm talking about this, think back also to the to the access waitlist material we talked about, because we're really interested in finding out what are the veterans' perspective on what do they mean by access, not just how long it takes, et cetera, but what's it mean to them. And a couple interesting things they have told us is first off, they describe timely access in terms of reasonable waiting. And so when we asked them about getting care, we did not ask about wait time. So I do want you to keep in mind, this is what they would bring up. And so veterans frequently talked about when it's appropriate to wait and when they're fine with waiting. And one of the really amazing things is they didn't talk just about I'm okay with waiting, but some of them talked about you should have to wait because other people are ahead of you. And they also talked about when it's urgent. So from a veteran perspective, access breaks down to about two things. When I need care immediately or everything else that's routine and I don't mind waiting. This makes a lot of sense. And actually, if you're a patient on your own, you can reflect. We all feel about the same way. Okay. The catch is, we currently don't have, a way to measure that, or, b, necessarily act on that, okay? And we don't routinely identify whether patients want to come in and see anyone right now, and we don't always necessarily know when they can wait and are okay with that. And certainly our performance measures, an appointment's an appointment, and we really don't have a way yet of distinguishing between which of those appointments, when do they need to be seen immediately, and when is it okay if you're going to wait for 6 months, and when are they fine with that? The other little side finding from this, and I consistently hear this when I do or listen to interviews with veterans, is they really see the VA as something they belong to. It's part of them. They go there with their brothers and sisters, and some of this willingness to wait really reflects the notion that we're in a very unique organization. Providers and staff, again, if you think back to the access waitlist crisis, which is really driven by this arbitrary 14-day demand, so here are some of the things we found. First off, about improving numbers, okay, this is a really nice quote that, at sites that we're doing well culturally, one of the things we found is they have this attitude that's captured by this one quote in which, the focus has got to stay on the quality of care, timeliness of care, and the numbers take care of themselves. If the numbers are drivers, we're going to have problems. Another finding which I love is that because we did site visits, we did them with a really broad range of staff, the unexpected finding. In this case, we heard from multiple sites that the role that probably has the greatest impact on access to care are MSAs, medical service assistants, and that without them it does not work well. We actually collected some quant data on the other side of this project which supported that. A missing MSA has huge impact on access. I think I wanted to bring in this finding because as a qualitative researcher, this is what we really love to do is be able to hear stories that we don't know and then share them up the chain and to the end users who can do something about that. MSAs, it's a problematic role. The job has gotten much more sophisticated as we've moved towards a data-driven culture. It also tends to be very low pay. They have a high turnover. The people who are, and there's little opportunity for advancement, so really good MSAs often move elsewhere. And one of the things at a national level they're concerned with now is, like, so how can we fix that? What do we do to make sure that that position, which is a real linchpin position, is we're able to train them, maintain them, and help develop them? And the last one is about same-day access, okay? And I wanted to include that because access can be affected. Even something like having a policy makes it easier for people to come in. This is really a life-saving issue about access, and it's not always about urgent care in the same way. What this person is describing is that when you have same-day access, the veterans, one thing we've communicated to veterans is if you show up, you will be taken care of. I don't have that expectation in my mental or in my healthcare system. I think very few people do. It has also got us to move away from thinking that all access has to be about face-to-face. But every site we visited, there's this huge commitment that if a veteran walks in the door, they will in some way or some shape be taken care of that day. Two lessons learned. Naivete can be a virtue, or participants might know more than we do. I think it's, as scientists, we sometimes think our strength is in what we know, and I think we need to always remember it's really in what we don't. And we've learned a lot about what access is really about, not because we're theorists, but because people are telling us. Our participants really do inform us and explain to us what we should be thinking about, what our next research project should be about, and what we need to know. The last piece on that project is we did come up with, I got very frustrated with writing reports, not because I hate writing reports, because they're not always very effective. The other way we tend to disseminate information is in papers, which tend to come out long after the project's over and before anything can happen. Papers, I think, are incredibly important. They're not a great way to have direct impact on the way we deliver healthcare. They're not timely enough. For this project, we utilized something called a slide doc, and this is the first project we've done this with, but we're going to be doing most of our projects this way, which is an interactive piece. And there's two elements of this I like. One is we generate a lot of short reports. This is now posted on the Pulse page, and we can do it in a timely manner that we can take our data. We still are plowing through those 3,000 pages of qualitative transcripts, and we can, as we get things defined, we can kick it up. This is an interactive web page where you can click on any one of these. It'll take you to overview and then a whole report connected with it. And so if you're interested in burdens and strategies for MSA's role in veteran access to care, you can click on it and find out about that. The other thing that we really kind of reached out or stretched ourselves on and has been very gratifying is this also allows us two-way communication at the dissemination and analysis phase. So both OVAC, our operational partner, ORH, and also we partnered with the Group Practice Manager Advisory Council to, as the data come, as we put in reports here, they're free to amend this. If we have identify a barrier that one of them has an answer to, they can then send it to the coordinator of us and the coordinator on the Pulse page, and we can put it right there. So if we put into the bottom, here's one of the barriers or next steps, and someone's got a form or a policy or a dashboard that can affect that, the next person looking at it can now have a resource. So it's interactive and mutable in real time. And lastly, we opened it up that we let the group practice managers in this case and also OVAC staff know we've got this big data set in. If you've got a question, tell us, and we'll do a deep dive and see what we can find. So several of these reports we've generated, actually, these are the current ones, have actually become in response to the questions live time from our operational partners. And that's been extremely effective for them because they can ask the question, get an answer. It's also very gratifying for us because I don't know about you, but if you feel like you do a lot of work, you do a lot of research, and it's not mutable, it's not usable, it's not having impact or being read, it's not satisfying. Lesson is dissemination matters. It's not an afterthought. We need to really think about how we do it and do it in ways that are highly effective and give our operational partners or other end users, such as group practice managers, something they need and can use. I want to talk lastly about the buy-in piece, which is care in the community. So part of how we're trying to improve access in the VA is through care in the community. First one of those that everyone's familiar with is the Veterans Choice Program. So we did an evaluation of that. I'm going to kind of go pretty fast because I ate up time not using my microphone or my technology properly. But as you all know, in response to the outcry of the access, way we came the wait list crisis, that veterans who have wait times of 30 days or longer or 40 miles from the nearest VMC or VA facility have access to outside care. So we did an evaluation of that, and two things we found is widely varying experience. For some veterans that got care in there, of course they love it, it's great, okay, and so they were really happy with it. However, the program is exceedingly complex. They often don't have, we had third-party administrators. Veterans we interviewed often could not tell the difference between who's the VA, who's the third-party administrator. And it also required heavily on the veteran to navigate it, which is really problematic. Two points I want to make about this. One is the nice strength of looking on the ground at people's experiences. It's really hard to say choice is good or bad. It depends on the veteran. It depends on their experience. You can't generalize out to exactly how good or bad it is, because for some people it was absolutely great for access. And as another one put us, it was just a horror story. Following up on that, we are now moving into the era of the Mission Act. We haven't evaluated the Mission Act because it's not fully rolled out. And it's not a single act. It's bundling all. It's seven different access efforts. My involvement in that was they did take look to the public for comments about quality standards. So one of the unique things about the Mission Act that goes beyond the Choice Act is that it is mandating quality standards, looking at VA quality of care, and also looking at community partner quality of care. And we had a lot of public input on that, so I did some analysis and of the comments on that. And a couple of things we came out of that we noticed. First off, there's a lot of challenges. Most of everyone in the community thinks it's great to add quality standards, but it's going to also propose some barriers, and I talked earlier about always looking out for unintended consequences. Well, we may have some headed for us in the Mission Act. First off, there's a lot of lack of existing standards and measures for some conditions. So not every condition you send out is going to have quality standards. So how do we compare them? The second is in the community, outside of large academic medical centers and when you get into private practice settings, there's not a lot of evidence-based practice in the community. It's not ubiquitous. In the VA, it's our mandate to do evidence-based practice. It's not going to be like that in the community. Finally, comparing collecting comparable patient data. Choice Act and the Mission Act doing care in the community is most needed in those communities where the VAs cannot serve, the small rural communities. Providers in those communities do not tend to, it's unlikely that they're going to be collecting a lot of quality care data. And so it's going to be difficult to compare. And the biggest challenge or the potential barrier to this improving access is that if we have a lot of burdens that if to serve vets means you have to start collecting new kinds of data that you don't normally do in your practice, and you have to meet new quality standards that you haven't historically, we may have inadvertently traded focus on quality for lower access because community providers may not want to buy into this. So this is something that they're currently working on. I haven't talked to Joe Francis and folks in that in the quality work group yet to see how it's being addressed. But in looking at that data, I wanted to really raise some of the potential issues that where we can try to avoid some of these unintended consequences. Next step. So I want to talk a little about future of the VA in addressing access, just two areas I'm interested in. The first one is a project that I think is really novel and really says a lot about where the VA may be going. And this is Project Atlas, or partner it through ORH and the Office of Community Care and the evaluation piece is Michael Ho is the PI on that. And what that project we're evaluating is looking at is providing telehealth, which we already do well. I think VA is probably the cutting edge of looking at innovative ways to do telehealth to bring care out into distant locations. But this one is actually, instead of putting people in the community or choicing them out, is using VA hubs, working with community partners. The first ones are Walmarts, VFWs, and American Legions, but they're also considering doing colleges, other settings, where the veteran can go to their local Walmart and go into the what they're calling it's a pod. It's an enclosed room which they can go in there through telehealth, meet with their mental health provider at this point. Eventually, when there's peripheral, being able to have peripherals in there, Phillips is developing those, and a veteran can go to their local place and see a VA provider in a community in a non-VA setting. And I think this is marvelous in two ways. One is veterans overwhelmingly like the VA and want to see their own providers, okay? And when given a choice, they choose to use the VA. Most of the time when they use choice in community care is because they don't have another option. And this allows us to go to provide care in places we don't have to be. And I think there's tremendous amount of opportunity in expanding this kind of work where we're actually partnering. It's not either VA or non-VA. It's VA and community partners. This is just a model of how Atlas works. It's a hub and spoke system. And lastly, and I know we've got a little time, I just want to talk about the very last thing I think is the future, and I have nothing in it because I have the foggiest idea how we're going to do this, but my overarching goal eventually before I retire is I do think we need to find a way to develop veteran-centered access measures that when we assess and we look at a report on how we're doing on access, they reflect not arbitrary numbers but two things. One is veteran preferences, because they're very good at deciding is it an urgent issue or is it long-term, do I mind waiting, and then clinical need. The 14 days or any other arbitrary standard will not reflect those two things. Clinically, there's times you got to get in right now, an hour's too long, and there's other times where waiting a year is absolutely fine, and the vet's fine with that. So, I think a long-term goal, and again, it's blank because I don't know how to do this, but hopefully I think at some point we'll get to where we can have kind of a sophisticated set of metrics that measures that we can really understand how we're doing on access that captures these things. So that's all I have. I open it up for questions or comments.
Thank you. So we do have a question that came in. And what data sources currently capture community care participants within the VA?
Oh, it's tricky. So in if their choice act, there's not one set, and so choice is been managed historically at the local level, and so there's choice coordinators each local, and they know what goes out, and they know what comes back. One of the challenges with choice defend is a lot of stuff that the coordination of records is can be problematic. And so that's one place they'll be handled at the local level. There isn't a large that I'm aware of corporate data warehouse way to track what goes in and out. And then if they're using Medicare or that's a hard thing to see. So I'm mostly going to say what's hard to see about that. So that's, for choice, it's pretty clear to say. A lot of sites use, rely more on contracts or community care and the community provider contracts. Some of the sites we went to did that heavily, and they'll have coordinators there. So it's all it's a lot of that's on the local level.
Thank you. That was the only pending question. Did you want to wrap up with anything? Any concluding comments?
No, I just want to thank everyone for dialing in, and appreciate it. And again, I do want to thank the folks who are there, and I feel bad for putting a thank you up because you leave out way more too many people. I'd especially like to kind of thank the leadership here, David O., Mike Ho, Steve Elliott, and Kari Levy here in the COIN, because I feel very fortunate to work in such a generative center that really supports doing the kind of work that can have impact. And just want to thank everyone else who's out there listening for the impact you have.